I was struck by the helpfulness of the skin the very day, the helpful appearance of the skin the very day after the aloe vera had then begun. And it is a fact that many times the simple remedies work just like a miracle, just immediately. But there are many times when the simple remedies do not work fast. Then what should we do? Should we abandon them and take a drug medication? Well, the answer to that is in what we have been instructed, and it goes like this. Ye do turn loose the arm of the Lord too soon. And I think that this often is the case with the use of the simple remedies. When we first began with the treatment of disease using simple remedies, one of the diseases that we wondered about treating was that of pneumonia. We wondered whether a person could be treated with pneumonia with the simple remedies. We had never treated anyone this way. We had a lady in our community who wanted to be treated with the simple remedies for her pneumonia. So we treated her case of pneumonia using the simple remedies, and it was quite a struggle. We had to work diligently with her to get her fever down. We had to go day and night often. She would have symptoms like coughing or just feeling very bad, and we would often be with her at night. We always had a nurse with her, someone who was doing hydrotherapy for her during the night. It was about 3 weeks before she was well. But when she was well, she was totally well. She didn't have to spend a month or 6 weeks or a year or two recovering from the effects of the antibiotics that we had once used and the expectorants and things of this nature. So we have come to believe that people with the simple remedies will respond as quickly, taking the total disease course, but that often they have to suffer a bit more at the beginning. But the total amount of suffering is going to be far less if they will start with simple remedies. There is this about the endorphins and the enkephalins, which some of you are acquainted with. Endorphins and enkephalins. Have only been discovered in the past 10 years or so, just very recently. To my mind, this is one of the most important of discoveries in medical science in this century. These substances are brain substances, brain hormones that turn on our internal mechanisms of healing in response to our need. Now, our need then would be pain or infection or anemia or whatever. So our system, our symptom must be of such a nature to stimulate the production of these substances to turn on our internal mechanism of healing. And therefore, if you have a little pain, and then apply, or if you have a lot of pain and then apply the remedy, the pain itself will activate the system. Do you see how that works? And therefore, sometimes we may suffer a little bit more at the beginning, but it is by faith that we must accept the fact that the total amount of suffering will be less if we use the simple remedies. Now, we may have another person who would be willing to tell us a simple thing that was used for a very serious and important problem. And I would like to call on this lady who I would like for her to tell you her name and tell you what the problem was.
My name is Eileen Ertle from Williamsport. 3 weeks ago, my son Dan, age 18, was in an automobile accident. He was thrown 40 feet from the car and landed on his head. As a result, he had extensive head injuries. There were 3 blood clots, and he was put in ICU for several days. And we were told that he would have brain damage. Well, while he was in ICU, we couldn't do anything because they administered drugs and give him the treatment that they want to. And they gave him a powerful drug to take down the swelling in his head. And that, in turn, causes ulcers, so they had to give him a drug to prevent ulcers. And so I said, you know, where does this all end? So when they brought him out of ICU down into the surgical ward, I asked them to take away all drugs. And, of course, they were very upset with me, and they said I would be responsible because they couldn't take these drugs away immediately. They had to be done gradually. And I talked to the dietitian about his diet. I didn't want him to have any junk food, no sugars at all, because all he was allowed was 7-Up and Jell-O and things like that. So they were quite concerned that Danny wasn't going to get the proper protein because he was a vegetarian. But a miracle really started to happen. For one thing, my church group gathered together and had special prayer for Danny. And another thing, we did what we could do. And he started to make a remarkable recovery. And the doctors and the nurses said to me they couldn't understand, you know, because usually it takes months to come where he has come in just 3 weeks. And so I brought him home. I wanted to get him home, get him in fresh air. I begged for the nurses to open the windows, and they wouldn't do it. So I got him home, get him in fresh air and sunshine and lots of water. And so the thought came to me to put a charcoal poultice on his head to reduce the swelling. So I mixed flaxseed and charcoal together and spread it on a cloth and covered his entire head with it. And the next day, I didn't tell too many people I had done this, and the next day I started to hear remarks about how Danny was responding so much better. And I said, that's because I put a charcoal poultice on his head. It was reducing the swelling in his brain. And I did it twice. And he's really come a long ways. In fact, we're hoping he can start school in a couple weeks. So I really thank the Lord for all that he has done. I know that he's really good. And natural remedies really do work.
Yes, indeed. Even for very serious things.
And I would like to make a comment on the matter of prayer. We are told that when a person has a very serious illness, that their problem may be greatly relieved by the faith of their physician, and the prayers of their physician can be beneficial for the person who is sick. I believe that there are indeed forces that can be initiated by heaven for the relief of suffering and for the curing of disease through our prayers and through our faith that could not be initiated if we did not have that faith. This is not a matter of just the psychology of the thing, although we do know that the endorphins and the enkephalins are designed by our Heavenly Father to work better when the person has faith, and the non-religious investigators who are investigating this will tell you that the faith of the patient will help the remedy to work. Now, of course, they say the faith in the remedy or faith in the physician. But we know that faith in God is the strongest faith that there is, and is also that specific quality of faith that God has designed to activate those chemicals which He has designed in the brain. If for no other reason, we should develop in ourselves faith. Faith so that we can be healed from disease. Faith so that our endorphin and enkephalin system can be activated through it. Now let us say that you are the sick person and you have faith, but you are simply too sick to exercise faith or to pray. Then there is some counsel for you under that circumstance also. And the counsel is this, that you should rest in the arms of the Savior and lean on the faith of your physician and others who are about you who have faith. And so it is good for us when we are sick to select a physician who has a deep faith. It is also well if we have individuals in our own homes and in our families who can exert this deep faith for the healing of our illnesses. Well, I thank these who have told their personal testimony, and I am certainly grateful that you have right here those who are willing to use the simple remedies, especially Dr. Piper. I know just what a struggle it is for a physician to get any faith in the simple remedies. We have been trained, and I emphasize the word training, we have been trained, and as the twig is bent, so grows the oak tree. And that is the way that physicians' training is. It is training not to believe in the simple remedies, in the remedies that nature provides. But if you will look in the syllabus on page 21, you will see the definition of a true medical missionary. This is the second paragraph on page 21. The true medical missionary will be wise in the treatment of the sick using the remedies that nature provides. And then he will look to Christ as the true healer of diseases. Now the threefold definition of a true medical missionary is coming up. Number one, the principles of health reform brought into the life of the patient. Number two, the use of nature's remedies. And number three, the cooperation of divine agencies in behalf of the suffering. And then we are given this promise that these will bring success. And every person who has experienced a healing should do just as Sister Piper said that she is doing. She is reading counsels on diet and foods and putting into effect in her life everything mentioned there. And this is the thing that God expects us to do, to put the principles of health reform into our lives. And especially is this necessary when we have been the subject of healing. Well, I thank the Lord for these cases, and I would like for you to turn in the syllabus to page 11. On page 11, we will study for a bit the subject of blood pressure. High blood pressure does not give a lot of symptoms early in the disease, and the person may have far advanced arterial disease before he understands that he has high blood pressure. And at every stage of high blood pressure, a person has a greater likelihood of dying of stroke. Let us take at these low levels. Let us say a person has a blood pressure of 100 over 50. As compared to a person whose blood pressure is 110 over 60, the person with 100 over 50 will have fewer strokes. Now, at 120 over 70, this person will have more strokes than the person at 110 over 60. And the person at 130 over 80 will have more strokes than the person at 120 over 70. With each step up that we go in a higher blood pressure, there are more strokes by far in that level of blood pressure than just one level below that. Now, admittedly, at 110 over 60, there are going to be very few strokes in these individuals. But there will be more strokes than at 100 over 50, far more strokes in this group. And even at 120 over 70, very few strokes, but far more strokes than at 110 over 60. Now, let us take a person who has a blood pressure of 200 over 100. How should we treat such an individual? Since we have already established the proven fact that as we go up the line, we increase the risk of getting a stroke. I believe it was in about May of 1982 that a report came out. It was first reported at the annual meeting of the American Cardiology Association. A report on a large number of people whose blood pressures were 200 over 100 or less. This is termed mild to moderate elevations in blood pressure, anything under 200 over 100. It was shown in this large study, which spanned a large number of years, that individuals who took no medication lived longer than did those whose medication brought their blood pressure down to within normal range. Now, since then, there have been several additional reports showing exactly the same thing, but I had never seen a report indicating that prior to 1982. Of course, the drug companies have funded most of the research done on blood pressure. So it is natural that not many drug companies selling involved in the commerce of pharmaceutical agents for blood pressure would be very interested in revealing such a finding as was discovered by those physicians who did this study. It was such a revolutionary thought that the president of the College of American Cardiologists got up at the meeting and commented on the fact that the study was revolutionary, on the fact that the study had been very well done, and that the committee who had reviewed the paper and the work could find nothing wrong with it, even after scrutinizing it. And you can imagine how they would scrutinize such a paper. The president of the college said, This report flies in the face of everything that we have used in the treatment of high blood pressure for the last 50 years. And this is a fact. Now, what shall we do then? Since we have seen by this report that for mild to moderate cases of blood pressure elevation, even neglecting the patient results in less death than if we give him blood pressure medication, shall we then just neglect the patient with high blood pressure, with mild to moderate high blood pressure? The answer is no. You should work with your patient and bring your patient's blood pressure back down in this way. Now let me tell you about a case history and tell you how we treated him. A man named Mr. Gilbert came into our Better Living Center one day. He looked as if he were dying. When he came into my office, he announced that he was dying. And he said this, while I know that I am dying, I am not going to the hospital. So don't think that I'm going to go. He was a retired Army sergeant. And he was every inch a sergeant. He told me what to do all along the way. Except that apparently his wife was a better sergeant than he, because he said that he was in my office because his wife had heard that we were doing some things with blood pressure that she hoped we would be able to do for him. He was being treated out at Martin Army Hospital for his high blood pressure and was on 3 blood pressure medications. His blood pressure was 220 over 120 and taking 3 medications. So with this kind of blood pressure and on medication, I agreed with him that he was probably dying. I did not say that out loud, but I certainly did agree with him. He looked very bad. His face had that, his skin had that sick appearance, puffy, dissipated appearing. He had bags upon bags under his eyes. He was 100 pounds overweight. He lumbered into my office. And when he told me that he was dying, I was very fearful that we would not be able to do anything for him. I felt that he probably had already given up hope. Nevertheless, I made out a long list of things for him to do, and you will find these things on page 11 of the little syllabus. Exercise is, of course, number one in the treatment of blood pressure. Some people will have their blood pressure to come right down to normal if they do nothing other than a run in place, which is item B under number one under exercise. Run in place twice daily for 6 minutes to reduce the blood pressure. This can be very helpful. Also, use of a rebounder or the use of a stationary bicycle or just taking a good long walk of about 30 minutes. Twice or 3 times a day, all of this for some people can be all that they need to reduce the blood pressure, especially lower blood pressure right back down into the very low ranges. Second item is that of diet. The diet is important in 3 ways. First, a non-stimulatory diet, free from caffeine drinks, alcohol, spices, and fermented or aged products. A substance in cheese, tyrosine, breaks down to tyramine, a chemical capable of constricting blood vessels and causing headaches or an increase in blood pressure. By the way, cheese is not put in the list with alcohol and fermented or aged products by accident. Cheese is itself a fermented product. When you ferment grapes, what is the product that you get? When you ferment grains, what is the product that you get? Whiskey. When you ferment milk, what is the product that you get? It is cheese. And so it is proper that we have put all of these together. And the tyrosine, which breaks down to tyramine, the chemical that constricts blood vessels, can also constrict bronchi to make a person who has asthma have a worse time with their asthma. Second thing is that of concentrated foods. And you can read this little paragraph. Let me point out that we give a diet altogether free from free fats. That would be margarine and butters. That would be also cooking oil, salad oils, fried foods, mayonnaise, all of those. And then the third thing that we do concerning diet has to do with salt. We remove salt from the diet of the person who has high blood pressure. Now, just as with the nightshades in treating arthritis, to cut down probably will not be adequate. The word is cut out. So you must cut out salt altogether. Now, if you will turn the page, you will see Dr. Lewis Dahl's guidelines for the production of 1,000 milligram or less salt diet per day. Number one is never add salt to food, stove or table. Dr. Lewis Dahl is a prominent cardiologist of our day. I would add to that also not at the factory either. So salt must not be added to food anywhere. Factory, stove, or table. Number two, avoid milk and milk products which are naturally high in sodium. Since mammary glands are very similar to sweat glands, and sweat glands put out a lot of salt, we could expect that mammary glands would too, and indeed they do. So, if you use even a small amount of milk, your diet will be high enough in sodium as to make it so that you cannot be under 1,000 milligrams of salt per day. Number three, use no processed foods. That would include meat, baked goods, canned vegetables, and some frozen. Number four, use no salted foods. That would be nuts, popcorn, and so forth. You must read all labels. You must buy nothing that comes from a vending machine. And with these guidelines, you can keep the salt intake to less than 1,000 milligrams. We had a man one time who came to Yuchi Pines with high blood pressure, who was put on our usual routine. He had a number of other things wrong with him than high blood pressure. And his high blood pressure failed to respond. We were treating him for all of his various ills, and everything was responding well except his blood pressure. 10 days went by, and his blood pressure had come down a little bit, but only a very small amount. So at the end of 10 days, we were reviewing his case, and the physician assistant was telling about his program and how he was faring on it, and was presenting this at medical conference. So the physician assistant said that he was tolerating his diet well. He was doing his exercise faithfully. He was getting his saline nasal baths for his sinusitis. And my husband said, saline nasal baths. They stopped the saline nasal baths, and the very next day, his blood pressure was right down to normal. He was getting just sufficient salt while he was not swallowing much. There was just sufficient salt from the saline nasal bath to make it so that his blood pressure was not coming down. So this can help you to understand that for most people, you need to be really strict about salt. Now, I'm aware that you'll be reading in various newspapers and health magazines and medical reports as well that salt may not be as important as calcium. But I feel that what you should do is to make certain that the person has plenty of calcium, but at the same time be certain that the person does not get salt. Now, if you do that, most people with high blood pressure will have the high blood pressure to come right down. Now, notice also item B under section 2, showing that apples can help to reduce the blood pressure. Dr. B.S. Levine found apples to have a curative effect on the blood pressure. After 3 days of apples, for the next 2 days, eat only fruit and salt-free whole grain bread for breakfast and vegetables and salt-free bread for dinner. Eat only one apple for supper. We put Mr. Gilbert on all of these things. I also wrote down on the sheet of paper that I wrote out for him that he should take a hot bath. You will find that mentioned in item 4, a hot bath at 104 degrees. A hot bath will invariably reduce a blood pressure, a high blood pressure. It will also reduce normal blood pressure. For this reason, the person who gets out of a hot bath will many times feel a little faint, because of the fact that the blood pressure has dropped so low during the bath. This has a very simple reason. You have brought so much blood from the interior of the body to the exterior of the body that the blood pressure falls sufficiently to make you feel that you're going to faint. So I sent Mr. Gilbert home with his sheet of paper that had many of these things written on it for him. The next day, I told him that I would not treat him since he refused to go to Yuchi Pines for treatment. I told him that I would not treat him if he were not willing to come every day to one of our facilities about the city of Columbus, health food store, a restaurant, or to our Better Living Center, to let someone there take his blood pressure. He promised that he would. So he went home. The next day he came back into our health food store there in Columbus, into Country Life, and had his blood pressure taken. And it had fallen just a little bit, maybe down around 210, over about maybe 110. I don't remember exactly what it was, but a little bit of falling. He was fasting. The next day by day, he came into one of our facilities and had his blood pressure taken, and the physician assistant who was on duty at the place would give me a call and tell me what was going on with his blood pressure. So the next week when I saw him, his blood pressure at that time was down to 190 over 105. And I said, well, Mr. Gilbert, I believe we'll be able to treat your blood pressure as an outpatient. And then he told me the story. He said, within 20 minutes after I got home last week, my wife had me in a hot bath. The next day, she had me on a fast. And the following day, she had me on nothing but apples. And after I went on that for 3 days, then she gave me salt-free whole grain bread and fruit. And I am very happy to be here today because this marks the end of this last week, which was an ordeal. And I said, well, how do you feel? He said, better than I have felt in years. I said, well, fine. I'm glad to hear that. So I said, don't neglect taking your medication right at the present. He said, oh, I left that off the second day. And I said, you mean your blood pressure has dropped like this and you've been off your medication for a week? He said, that's right, and I never intend to take it again. Well, a long story with lots of human interest. This man had been totally uninterested in religion and in God until the time that his blood pressure started coming down. When his blood pressure started coming down, he began to get interested in religion. And while this man has not been baptized, he still does not claim to be a Christian. He is quite a lot more religious. He has cleaned up his language quite a lot. It is now a joy to be around him because he speaks cheerfully. He no longer thinks he is going to die. And his son, through the influence of all of this work, this contact that he had with us, became religious. And while he did not join our church, he did join another church and has become a minister in that church. And I believe that one day he will be a Seventh-day Adventist. He certainly eats and talks like a Seventh-day Adventist already, and I think that he will someday be one of us. To make a long story about Mr. Gilbert's blood pressure a very short one, a few months ago, one of my assistants took his blood pressure, and it was just where it was the last time I took it, which was 112 over 72, right where it has been for several years. So we believe that blood pressure problems should be treated, but should be treated with simple remedies. Now, are there any questions about this subject? Yes.
I start this tomorrow, and I stop my medication, I'm supposed to go to the doctor next month, and I know he needs to don't get off of it.
All right, the question is, what... Okay.
I can quit taking my tenement, right?
All right, the question is this. If I should start, my blood pressure is very high, and I take a blood pressure medication, or maybe two or three for it, and I start this routine today, can I drop my blood pressure medication? And the answer is, you should not. You should taper off your blood pressure medication as your blood pressure comes down. As your blood pressure comes down, it is quite safe for you to taper off your blood pressure medication. If your blood pressure comes down precipitously, by all means, reduce your blood pressure medication. Okay? Because blood pressure medication for a person who has a low blood pressure can even be lethal. Yes.
You say 104 degrees for that bath temperature.
Yes.
Question, how do you regulate that temperature?
Okay, how do you regulate the temperature of your bath in a bathtub? Just get in an ordinary bathtub. But before you do, go down to the hardware store and buy an outdoor thermometer. Just an ordinary one for under $5. Take that into the bath with you. Just set it up there down at the end and look at it occasionally. Sometimes you can get bath thermometers that float in the water that are on a little piece of wood or a little piece of styrofoam. Just turn them upside down in the bath water and just check it from time to time and keep it about 104. Now, let me ask you a thought question. Why would you not use a bath temperature, say, of 113? A person can tolerate 114 quite nicely. Most people would not willingly get into a bath at 115. You would have to be put into that. But why would you not give a person a hot bath with high blood pressure at 113? You can give a person who does not have high blood pressure a hot bath at that level. But why would you not put a person with high blood pressure in a hot bath at 113? It actually constricts blood vessels. Extremes of heat, extremes of cold constrict blood vessels. Have you ever and smooth muscle of all kinds. Have you ever had it to happen that you started drawing a bath in the bathtub, and while you were doing some other things in the bathroom, the water got too hot? And there you are with a tub full of hot water, but the last time you checked it, it was just fine. And so you stepped into your tub of hot water and your hair stood on end. And every goosebump on your body stood up tight. Have you ever had that to happen to you? This is the constriction of smooth muscle that occurs with extremes of temperature. Now, it is important for you to remember this, because do you recall, you may be faced with a situation sometime that will help you, that this knowledge will help you. Do you recall when, in the days of home births, when the husband would go to town to get the doctor would say to the husband, go back home and put the water on to boil. Well, there was a widespread myth for a long time that was just to keep the husband busy and out of the doctor's hair. But that is not true. You will find in the medical literature in the 1910s and 1920s, you will find a number of reports of, no, it's the 1810s, 1810s and teens and 1820s. You will find a number of reports from the old physicians of stopping postpartum hemorrhage by a vaginal douche of hot water. So if you are ever faced in a field situation with a home birth and a postpartum hemorrhage results, don't forget that a douche with hot water will often stop a postpartum hemorrhage. And the old doctors used to say it would stop as if by magic, and I believe it. I saw this occur in surgery one time when we had a badly macerated and lacerated person from an automobile accident. We were pumping in blood at all four extremities and losing ground all the time. And we were looking around in the abdomen trying to find bleeding points. And we had looked here and there, and we had traced out this artery and that artery. And nothing was getting us ahead of our blood loss. The blood would just well up into our field so that we couldn't even see where we were trying to trace out the arteries. And so we finally received the counsel from the head of the Department of Surgery to try the hot lap packs. So the nurse went running out. Very shortly she brought back in some hot lap packs that she had dipped in hot water at 124 degrees. We had to handle these with tongs. They were too hot for us to handle with a bare hand. But you will not get blistering until you have reached 124 degrees. The hot lap packs were at 120 degrees. 124 degrees for 1 minute will give you blistering in where the circulation is normal. 102 degrees may give you, or at least 106 degrees may give you blistering in a person who has poor circulation, say in the feet. But in a person who has good circulation, you will not get blistering until you have exposed the skin to 124 degrees for 1 minute. Within seconds of our packing in the hot lap packs, we pulled out the hot lap packs and had a dry field. We were able to trace around and see several bleeding points that we had been unable to discover when we had blood all over the field. And within a matter of 2 minutes, we had staunched the bleeding so that the anesthesiologist was saying, we're a little bit better, we're in a little better condition than we had been with the patient. So if you will remember these things about very hot water, it can be a great help to you in staunching bleeding. Any other questions? Yes.
I have some friends who cannot sleep nights without sleeping pills.
Yes. All right. What to do for sleeping? All right. I have plenty that I can say about how to sleep. Would you turn, please, to page 3? And we should learn how to sleep without using sleeping pills. Sleeping pills borrow sleep from the future. And you're going to have to pay it back. If you use a sleeping pill, and this is a principle of medical practice, if you use a sleeping pill, we can guarantee to you that your total amount of sleeplessness in your lifetime will be greater than if you did not use the sleeping pill. Remember that point. Do not take sleeping pills. They are not good for sleeplessness. Pastor.
I know of a young lady that she's a nurse, in fact, and she took sleeping pills and aspirin together and she never woke up.
All right, I'd like to comment on that. A nurse took sleeping pills and aspirin together and never woke up. The aspirin breaks the mucus barrier in the stomach and inflames and irritates the bowel, bringing blood to the area. And drugs that are exposed to the now very blood-filled bowel can take up large quantities of the medication very quickly, raise the blood level very high to the point of respiratory arrest. If you are an allergic person, allergic to foods or allergic to something else that is swallowed, and you take aspirin, the same thing occurs, making it so that the allergenic substance that you take by mouth rushes into the bloodstream because of the increase in blood flow to the bowel, making it so that you can take up large quantities of the allergenic substance into your blood, and this can cause an intense reaction, even death, from anaphylaxis or anaphylactic shock. Just recently, a case was reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association, I believe it was, of a young boy, age 15, who was sensitive to peanuts. He was quite sensitive to it when he ate them by mouth. And he ate a food that had peanuts in it after he had taken aspirin for a headache. He went into shock. They were able to bring him out, but he had 2 or 3 days in an intensive care unit because of the fact that he had taken up so much of the peanut allergen that it had thrown him into an anaphylactic shock. Now, on page 3, some material about sleep. We have studied some of this about sleep before midnight being twice as beneficial as sleep after midnight, the influence of growth hormone, and the influence on proper sleep, on such things as memory and learning and the like. It is better to sleep between 6 and 9 hours daily, as persons who sleep less than 6 or more than 9 tend to live shorter lives than those sleeping 7 to 8 hours. Following are some suggestions for those who have a problem sleeping that may induce sleep without drugs. Number 1, have vigorous exercise, preferably in the soil, and that every day. Now, the exercise that people take should be described as vigorous, though not violent. Now, that is a prescription. Let us all say it together. Vigorous, though not violent. One more time. Vigorous, though not violent. Now, you have a prescription. This prescription is for well people as well as sick people. Violent exercise is not good for one. Now, what is violent exercise? Well, what for me might be just child's play might be for a person who has been sick for 6 weeks, violent exercise. So we must study the individual. And usually the individual can follow his own body signals and tell you what is violent exercise. So if a person tells you this is too much exercise for me, believe them. But then the next day, after they have taken a certain amount of exercise and done so without ill effect, believe also that they can increase that exercise by just a little bit. If they have been able to walk a half block, then the next day, if they have no ill effect from the half block, the next day they should be able to walk a few paces beyond half block. And day by day, they should be able to increase the exercise until they are able to do a normal amount. Number 2, no new activity late in the day. No nap after dinner. Many people get drowsy after a meal. What is the rule that we have about lying down after a meal? The word is never. That's what Seventh-day Adventists have taught for over 100 years concerning lying down after a meal. Never lie down after a meal. Why is that? What is the medical reason? Dogs were investigated, which they were given an ordinary meal for a dog, and then were required to sleep. They were required to sleep with a short-acting barbiturate that only lasted about 30 minutes. At the end of the time, when the barbiturate was just beginning to wear off, they gave the animal just a little prod, and the animal stood up and stretched and yawned and took a big breath. And when he did that, he squeezed from his lymphatic system into his blood system some fat. And so the researchers found this kind of thing. Here are the blood cells all through the blood vessel, like so. And here was a big globule of fat, like this, plugging up small coronary vessels and small vessels in the head as well. So if we lie down after a meal, we make the emulsified fat, or we set up a condition where the emulsified fat can break into globules into themselves and make a little wad of fat that then gets into the general circulation and can plug up blood vessels in the heart and in the brain. And while this does not kill us, it does not give us a heart attack or a stroke, it does diminish our total excellence of good health and good mind by a certain degree. And of course, we should all be interested in preserving ourselves in the very best of health. When people have less and less acute minds throughout their lifetimes, there are often reasons for this, such as this. Our mind should be just as keen at the age of 120 as it is at the age of 20. We should be capable of learning just as well at the age of 95 as we are at the age of 25. Now, it is true that as we get older, our interest specializes so that we are not interested in as many things as we once were. But studies done in the last 15 years show that people learn just as well if their health is as good at age of 75 or 85 as they do at age of 25 or 35. The reason that the interest specializes and narrows down is, I believe, just that we have seen a lot of things and heard a lot of things, and we don't care to repeat it anymore. And so our interest sort of narrows down. But it isn't that we cannot learn, nor cannot remember. Sometimes my children say to me, "Mama, I told you this or that, and you forgot it." And I say, "I don't believe you told me." Have you had that to happen to you? And then I begin to understand what it is, because I start watching myself. And when they tell me something that I already know about, I just turn that off and don't listen. I start thinking about something else. And I expect to turn back on in time to hear the next thing that they say, but sometimes I turn on a little late and they've already said something else. And then they think that I'm forgetful, but I know that I'm not. It's just that I wasn't interested. Now the next thing. Have an evening ritual that is regularity in all things. Let bedtime and arising time be constant. We should not be so irregular in these things that every night is a new experience so far as going to bed is concerned. It should be just the same thing. That is, if you have difficulty in going to sleep. Now, you understand that all of these things that I am telling you about helping people to go to sleep are things that people who have difficulty in going to sleep should do. One time, a patient who was living in my home having a great problem with sleeping. And so I told her that she should not sleep in the afternoon. Well, one night we had a birth, and I was up all night long. And the next night, instead of going to supper, I took a little nap instead. We were going to have a program at our chapel that night. And so I took a little nap instead. And the next day, my patient said to me, "Dr. Thrash, you broke a rule yesterday." "Oh, what rule was that?" "You slept in the afternoon." I said, "Oh." I also slept very well at night, too, as I do every night. Having been blessed with that kind of thing, I believe people can train themselves to sleep well. When I first got married, my husband would lie down and go to sleep. And I would lie there resentful of the fact that I was having to go to sleep. There were so many things that I wanted to do, and I was having to sleep. And this had been my pattern for a long time, for many years, that I resented having to sleep. And I said to my husband one day, "How is it that you're able just to put your head down on the pillow and go right to sleep?" He said to me a very simple thing. He said, "That's what I go to bed for." And And I thought, well, that's very easy. I think I will practice that. And so I started just making that the thing that I went to bed for. If I had something that I needed to think about, I sat up until I was ready to quit thinking about it. Then when I went to bed, all I had to do was just to lay my head down on the pillow, and instantly I went to sleep. It didn't take very long to train myself into that. Notice these other several things. Item 5 is a very important thing on sleeping. Children will often have their sleep interfered with by television or by reading stimulating things like comics. Children will often have nightmares in response to television, even if it isn't what one might call bad television. Any kind of television can give a child a nightmare. Many times, children's nightmares are caused by food sensitivities. Item 6 mentions being well hydrated. The brain is, some parts of the brain, up to 90% water. The brain functions a lot better when we are well hydrated. And individuals who go to bed to sleep will find that sleeping is a positive action of the brain. It is another positive thing. It is not the absence of all brain activity. It is another type of activity. So a well-hydrated brain and one that has plenty of fresh air, as in item 7, can function better to do this positive thing of the brain. Comfortable bed and comfortable warm clothing. Many people have leg cramps at night, and this is the thing that interferes with their sleeping. So they wake up at night with a leg cramp, maybe a cramp that only lasts a few seconds. Then when they move around a little bit, the leg cramp goes away, and they don't know what it was that woke them up. But if they will have warm extremities, leg cramps are much less likely to occur, and especially if the little stretching exercise that we have already presented to this group is done, if this kind of stretching exercise is engaged in, then we can expect that the person could sleep better just by being warmer and by avoiding leg cramps. All right. There are some other things, and you can read all of those. Any other question? Yes.
Are antibiotics drugs?
Question is, are antibiotics drugs? Yes, indeed, they are drugs, and they increase your risk of getting cancer. Would you turn, please, to page 15? And there you will see a list of drugs in item 20. Likely to cause cancer. And this is by no means a full list. There are probably 80 or 100 drugs now that are known to cause cancer. These are just some of the commoner ones, but by no means all of the common ones. Notice that certain antibiotics lead the list. Tetracycline, penicillin. I think it is very unfortunate that youngsters are given tetracyclines for acne, tetracyclines being known to increase one's risk of getting cancer. And the earlier in life animals are exposed to a cancer-producing agent, the more regularly they come down with cancer. You will see a number of other things there. Notice antihistamines are in this list. Antihistamines are used for such things as hay fever and the like.
I'm using charcoal to try to reduce tumors. How often will you make a poultice?
Question is about charcoal and its use in reducing tumors. If the swelling is due to something like just a sprained ankle or swelling that a person gets in the ankle, I would just use that once a night. If the person has an internal tumor, then I would approach the whole body in the treatment of the tumor, and not just with charcoal. I would give charcoal by mouth and expect that I might get a reduction in the tumor. If it were under the skin, I might put a compress on the cancer. But I would also give hot compresses or hot baths. Hot enough to raise the body temperature, maybe up to 103, 104. Keep it there for 45 minutes if the patient could tolerate it. We have some instructions on how to treat cancer in our book, Home Remedies, which will be for sale after our meeting closes. Question in the back. Okay. Question is about psoriasis and how to treat that. If you will send a self-addressed envelope and $1 and ask for our material on psoriasis, we'll be happy to send you. More than one sheet. I've forgotten how much it is, but it's a discussion on psoriasis. As I recall, it's 3 or 4 sheets on the treatment of psoriasis. Question here. Question is how to make a charcoal poultice, and it is so easy. You just take some charcoal powder, which you will be able to see at our health education materials table. Take 2 or 3 tablespoons full of charcoal powder. Mix a little bit of water with it. Now, a word to those who are wearing their white suits when they mix up the charcoal. Stir it slowly because it is very light. And it jumps out very easily. So take it in a tall glass, put it in the bottom, stir slowly with a small amount of water. Then as it gets wet, it is of course very dry and takes a little while for it to get stirred in. So stir it in slowly. Then when it is nicely stirred in and you have a paste about as thick as let's say tomato ketchup, about that thick. Then take a paper towel, large enough to cover the area that you're going to use it on. Spread it over the paper towel and fold the paper towel over one time. Now, if it is only a small compress that you need, then put it in one corner, fold it over, and then fold it over again, and the part that has only one layer of the paper toweling, you will put that next to the skin. That's the way to make a charcoal compress. Now, the way to put it on is put it directly on the skin with only one layer of the paper toweling between the skin and the charcoal. Then put a piece of plastic over that. The plastic will prevent the drying of the charcoal. Then over that, put some kind of bandage or snug-fitting garment, like maybe a glove if it is on the hand, or a mitten, so that it will not move at all. And then let the person go to bed with that.
Why not directly on the skin?
You may put it directly on the skin if you would like. Works very nicely that way. You have to work a little bit more when you take it off, but it works very nicely that way. Now, how often to change the compress? If it is something ordinary, something like a pain in an arthritic joint, you may leave it on overnight. If it is something like a snake bite, change it every 10 minutes. A brown recluse spider bite, change it every 10 minutes. And for things in between, the mild thing and the severe thing, change it correspondingly less frequently. Yes? Okay, how to treat eczema. If eczema is caused by more than one thing, it usually has a cause, it usually also has a trigger. The cause may be some food sensitivity. The trigger may be soap. Or the trigger may be scratching it nervously. Let us say a person is nervous, is in a very tense situation, and just feels a little nervousness everywhere, but you can reach the inside of your arm very nicely. And so you find that by stroking the inside of the arm, it sort of relieves a little bit of tension, and so the person scratches it a little bit, and pretty soon he has an eczema there, has a dermatitis there. It may get to be chronic, because then it itches. Once you start scratching it, it begins to itch, and pretty soon you have an uncontrollable situation. But let's say it's on the hands, which is a typical place to get eczema. You will notice if you look at it under a hand lens that it has tiny cracks in the skin. These tiny cracks can be easily kept open by scratching. Therefore, treatment number one is no scratching. That means be strict. Whatever is required to prevent scratching, you must do. If that means putting bandages on the area and then covering that with mittens or gloves, do that. Whatever you must do to prevent scratching, it will not heal as long as the person continues to scratch it. Because every time they scratch, they open up little cracks. Number two in the treatment is use no soap. Number three in the treatment is every time the person washes the hands with water, while they are still wet, reach over and get a little lump of Vaseline. Rub this between the hands vigorously. And then smooth it on in the way, in the direction of the skin lines, so that you would go around the extremity like this. No rubbing like this. Why? You would open up the little cracks. So you must go in this direction. Now, the Vaseline milk is better for it than plain Vaseline, because of the fact that it incorporates a little bit of moisture also and softens the skin and makes it a bit more pliable in the area of the eczema. And that can be, and it also protects against anything getting into the little cracks that keep on with the irritation. No, it's what you make. What you make with a hand still wet and the little lump of Vaseline. You make Vaseline milk by rubbing it together between the palms. And then smooth this Vaseline milk gently on the area. It doesn't have to be thick, just has to be a light coating over the area where the eczema is.
What if that don't work?
All right, what if that doesn't work? Then what do you do? Well, write me a letter, tell me what you have done, and I will make some other suggestions for you. And you might like to write for our same way, a self-addressed envelope and $1, and request our section on how to treat dermatitis, and we'll be happy to send you our little thing on that. Question.
Would you make a comment about fever per se, especially for children? Why or why not leave it alone for at least 24 hours?
All right. Question is about fevers. Fevers in children should be treated with a hot bath. They should not be reduced unnecessarily. You will remember the discussion that we had on endorphins and enkephalins. A fever turns on or lays a base for the turning on of our internal mechanisms for infection control and for fever reduction. If we unnecessarily bring down a fever, say with aspirin or with a cold bath, if we do so without treating the basic disease at the same time, such as a hot bath would do, then we have done the body a disservice. A hot bath, you will find in our book, Home Remedies, on page 111, a schedule for children and for adults also, with the beginning temperature, how hot to have the hot bath, and how long to keep them in the bath. Always follow the treatment for a fever with a cold mitten friction and let them go to bed to sweat for a while in bed. And you can easily reverse the a heat conservation mechanism that the patient is in, and the patient will do quite well. The hot bath is a treatment for the underlying disease as well. Question. All right, the question is, how high do you let the fever go before you bring it down? I don't like it to go even higher than 99 before I'm working with it to bring it down. I start right at 99, I give a treatment. You see, I'm not really working with a fever, I'm working with a disease. And a hot bath is the treatment. Because the fever, if I give the fever treatment and bring the mouth temperature artificially up to 103, then I will be turning on the endorphin system. And this then will help the person to start healing his disease. That's what my intention is. Fever is just a symptom. And you must not treat the fever, you treat the patient. Good question. Yes. Okay, the question is about salt substitutes. I do not like to use them at all because potassium chloride, which many of them are, is no better for the body than sodium chloride. It just lesions the body in another way. So it's better for you to retrain the appetite. Some years ago, I decided that I would go off all salt for a period of time, just so that I could see how much problem it was to my patients when I told them, leave off all salt. And I found myself giving this instruction quite often. And so I wondered what it would be like if I myself went off salt for a while. So for a period of 6 months, at no time did I use any salt. And I had a cook at that time who was leaving all salt out of the food. So there was no salt put in food at the table. We put no salt in our food when we can it or freeze it. And I didn't add any at the table, so there was no salt in my food. This went on for 6 months, and I found that by the end of 6 months, I didn't care whether I had salt or not. I was just as happy with food without it as I, born and died and died in the wool, southerner, who uses 7 to 15 times more salt than the rest of the country. Even I, a southerner, could get along quite nicely without salt. And I believe it's just a matter of retraining the appetite to like your food without salt.
What about the vegetized salt?
Vegetized salts are just salt with an extract of vegetables added to it. It is less salty than ordinary salt because of the presence of the vegetable extract. But because of the fact that people use more of it, they don't usually come out too much to the good. Question.
If you don't have high blood pressure, is there any reason to eliminate salt from your diet?
Question is, if you don't have high blood pressure, is there any reason to remove salt from the diet? Yes, there are a number of other conditions that are associated with a problem in this way. Take the premenstrual syndrome. Take migraine headaches. They can both respond very nicely. Persons with asthma will sometimes respond. Some people who have sleeplessness at night will respond to the subject of leaving off salt. If you're treating a disease, you should cut it out.
Uh-huh.
No. For the ordinary person, I don't believe there is any reason for us to cut out salt. Cut it down if you're a southerner. Yes.
Do you have a remedy for something like that?
Okay, the question is, do we have a home remedy for hay fever instead of antihistamines? And indeed we do. Just take our syllabus, turn to page 20, eliminate all of these foods in the fourth column. This is the list of the top 10 foods causing food sensitivities. Yes, do away with all of them, all at one time. Yes. All right? Okay, the question is about vitamin supplements. Councils on Diet and Foods, page 322, says that all elements of nutrition needed to make good blood can be obtained from fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. My faith is so simple that if it says it there, I believe it, even if I can't understand it. Some years ago, some 17 years ago, my family decided that we would test that statement in Councils on Diet and Foods. And from then till now, we have taken nothing except fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and a few nuts. We have not taken any vitamin supplements of any kind, and I was never in better health in my whole life than I am now. We'll take one more question, and then Glenna.
What about if you are allergic to gluten?
All right, the question is, what do you do if you are allergic to gluten? What you should do is this. You should communicate with me privately when I am at Yuchi Pines, and I will be happy to send you some recipes that we use for our gluten-sensitive individuals. We'll be around after... Yes, it's hard on the cook, very hard on the cook. We'll be around after the meeting is over, and if anyone would like to ask further questions, we will be happy to do so.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.